Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Stephen Callender. Stephen is the founder and CEO of Foster Commerce. Foster Commerce are B2B e-commerce specialists, and they work exclusively with the Craft CMS platform and the Craft Commerce module. They build really customized solution for B2B merchants, and we had a fantastic conversation about the pros and cons of build versus buy for B2B e-commerce solutions. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to B2B Commerce Corner. Commerce Corner is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast discussing all things B2B commerce through the lens of agencies, consultants, merchants, and more. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Stephen Callender from Foster Commerce to the pod. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mate, I had to return the favor. You had me on your podcast, which I understand is due to come out shortly, which I'm super excited about. It was a heck of a lot of fun speaking with you guys for that hour conversation. You asked me some very fun, very tricky questions about Mexico, which I loved. You put me on the spot. Okay. Always love being put on the spot. I think I only answered one or two, or maybe one and a half out of three I got right, or something like that. I'll take the L on that one, but it is awesome to have you here with me today, mate.
I appreciate it. I do have to follow up on that real quick because you won a thing. So I have to pay it forward. I'm supposed to give a reward to one of the people, the person who was next on your, that you were on your list to talk to, was supposed to get a $25 Amazon gift card. I got to get that finalized.
Don't worry. I'll send across a couple names for you to pick out of a hat. How does that sound?
It's wonderful.
Love it. And you are the founder and CEO of Foster Commerce. You've been doing this e-commerce thing for a long time now, about 12 years at Foster and in the e-commerce space, even longer than that. So I think much like me, we've got the odd gray hair to show for our trouble of being in this awesome game we call e-commerce. And I wanted to get you on to have a chat about B2B e-commerce, because I know you guys specialize in the B2B e-commerce space, as do I. Absolutely love it, have a passion for it. I feel like the market is finally coming to us after a long time feeling like we were out in the wilderness trying to trumpet the clarion call of B2B e-commerce. And finally, it feels like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Finally, people are starting to follow us into the B2B e-commerce promised land. And not to sound too prophetic, but I tell you, I noticed a sea change happen truly. And I've said this before, and it bears repeating, that during COVID, a lot of B2B brands realized just how vulnerable they were to disruptions to their traditional field sales model. And basically all of their channels, oftentimes these B2B brands didn't even have a marketing team at all, let alone a digital marketing team, let alone e-commerce capabilities in the business. And I tell you, the shit proverbially hit the fan for a lot of these brands. And I tell you, it created that first wave of, I think, brands realizing, we got to figure this e-commerce thing out. Otherwise, it could be the death of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we saw the same thing on our side too. We saw some people who were willing to invest in areas that they hadn't. Absolutely. And you combo that, and I think we've talked about this too, but you combo that with the other side of the buying side of the expectation that people want to, and they expect to be able to just not have to talk to a sales rep the slow way always. And so the combo of those two forces, there's more forces probably at play too, but those two alone it's waking some people up. And so it's fun to be on that side of it, to be on the solution side for people. Absolutely.
And it's interesting because if I look back way back, even when I was in the hospitality industry as my first career, and when I was managing restaurants and basically having to be the F&B manager and having to make purchases B2B, of equipment, food, supplies, glassware, wine, beer, all that sort of stuff. I remember that when my reps would come to see me, the coolest part about them coming to see me was not them sitting down with their order book and saying, okay, would you like three bottles of this or a case of this? Or do we need to top you up on Asahi beer? That was not what made me feel valued and special when these B2B field sales reps came to see me in the hospitality. It was, hey, this is what we've got new. This is the stuff that's coming into the country for the first time. You have the opportunity to be the first restaurant to be carrying this product. We've seen great demand on these ranges. We have proverbially, from the feedback from the industry, says this is going really well. It was the it was more the insights, the intelligence, the almost business consulting in a very light way that they would provide. And just the fact that I liked hanging out with them, having a chat with them and having a beer with them.
Yeah.
That was the piece that to me added value, not them bringing in an order pad in and saying, how much do you need this week? That was not the part that added the value for me. And I think that many B2B brands are finally starting to realize that manually taking orders via an account rep, an inside salesperson, a customer service desk, whatever it might be, that, or worse yet, accepting orders, and I still have a lot of brands I know that do this, accepting orders via fax, accepting orders via CSV file that's attached to an email that then gets emailed to your account rep. These are all still very common in the B2B space. But that's primarily because the businesses doing the selling haven't adapted, not so much that the buyers still want to buy that way.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. So this, if that's happening, or your experience too, and obviously that happens for other people, where there is the relationship aspect of these sales, right? So the devil's advocate is, I want to keep those human relationships because it's those things that keep the relationship strong and why they keep buying with us. I think of like Dunder Mifflin Paper and like The Office, the US version of it, right? All that stuff of, it's those relationships and it's that customer service that we're there for you. And the devil's advocate side of, if we go full digital and then you lose that relationship piece of these long-term contracts, like B2B is a long-term process typically. It's not, all of a sudden I'm going to buy a bunch of this stuff. You got to figure out the right configurations, all the right values, all the price. So there's still a relationship being built. And so I guess what's your thought? What are you seeing on that side of the devil's advocate side of, I don't want to kill our relationships. I still want salespeople that are establishing relationships because those are still foundational to us keeping contracts and renewing contracts and that piece. But how do we do digital transformation and have this human connection that kind of really is this glue that kind of keeps the relationship longer? Have you had those conversations? What are you seeing? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I've got two answers to that. And the first is, actually, I would argue that digital transformation within these B2B businesses actually frees up field sales, inside sales, and customer service to do the human side more. Because instead of bringing an order back to the office and keying it into an ERP system or being customer service with their headset on and trying to give a little bit of consultation, answer questions, and then maybe key the order directly into ERP or into a CRM that then goes to sales rep for approval. And then the sales rep ultimately approves that order to be put into the ERP for fulfillment or the WMS for fulfillment. I would argue that is a tremendous amount of time wasted on what I would call a pure admin function. We're keying orders in. We're making sure that it's being placed against the right account. We're making sure that they're getting the right pricing. We're making sure that the right MOQs are being enforced, that we're selling by the case, if we only sell by the case, and that the buying increments are correct. We're doing a tremendous amount of wheel spinning, what I call wheel spinning in the B2B space, just because that's the way it's always been done. It doesn't mean it's the right way. It just means it's the way it's always been done. So that's the first thing. I would say that digital commerce, whether that be EDI, punch out, self-service, there's three primary modes of digital commerce in e-commerce in B2B, and I've just described those. But regardless of which mode you implement, or all three potentially in some cases, the reality is that it does free up a tremendous amount of internal time to focus on what matters, which is the relationship part, which is the part I've always appreciated in the B2B space. That's the first thing. Second of all, especially for replenishment ordering, back in the day, I would have much preferred to simply have my standard order that I ordered every single week, that maybe there might be some slight variations to it every week, but generally it was the same stuff every week. 90% of the order was identical. And I could just go in there, I could have my shopping list, I would add the whole thing to my cart, make any minor tweaks that needed to be added, and boom, I could have that order on the way in literally a matter of minutes versus having to go through and note down what my previous order was and keep track of that and then give the new information to my sales rep and maybe print it out. What I used to do is I used to document everything in a CSV file, in a Excel spreadsheet, and then I would just print that out and I would hand it to my account rep when she came and visited me in the store. And I think back on that and I think, gosh, if we could have had a really cutting edge e-commerce experience, it could have saved us both a tremendous amount of time, at least for the reordering portion. So sure, maybe they would come and see me and they would tell me about new things. And maybe that I would order some things as a one-off. Maybe it's a new dishware line or new cutlery line or whatever it might be. But for those replenishment orders, I think e-commerce is placed super well to unburden everyone in that scenario. I think the final piece that I'll throw in there is that now with particularly AI at scale, the kind of insights that are provided by an account manager who knows the inside scuttlebutt of the industry and they know what's selling well inside the business and they know they're getting feedback from the market and they're just, it's all gut feel, right? Now, with personalization technology being what it is, and especially in the B2B space, because we know so much more about our customers than we do in the B2C and D2C world, right? Yeah. Most personalization technology in the B2C world, rather, is wisdom of the crowd. It's wisdom of the crowd technology. It's not we know this person inside and out. It's wisdom of the crowd. What did somebody buy in certain situations? What did they buy with other products? What works in this demographic, etc. We know down to the nth degree so much information about our B2B customers. That deep personalization is so much easier at scale online than it is via the human connection that I think we can personalize the experience far better through digital channels than we ever could through personal channels. And I'm not saying that we want to replace the personal channels, but I'm saying that we can add value in different ways versus an e-commerce experience.
So ultimately, people don't need to be worried about that piece, what I'm hearing you say too, which I'd agree, is there are actually benefits in there's the flip side of digital transformation for these B2B companies that like the fear of holding on to the status quo of losing that personal relationship kind of thing is mitigated possibly by one, the benefits, and two, the fact that it's not 100% removed. Like it's still there. It still exists. It's still, there's still relationships as people want to build them and as they have them in a sense. So I like that answer. I agree with you.
And I think there's also something that these B2B brands don't think about, which is opportunity cost. And yeah. This is the thing that I'm having conversations with my clients about every single day. There is a large and growing percentage of your B2B customers that did not grow up in a world where field sales reps were coming to see them. They are digital natives. I think something like, I read a statistic the other day, it may have been from DC360. I forget where the statistic came from, but I think it was something along the lines of 40%+ of B2B buyers now are digital natives, meaning that they grew up in the era of e-commerce. And for those people, they have zero expectation that they will ever see a field salesperson in person, physically in person. They're quite happy to have the Zoom call. They're quite happy to have the G Suite call with them. And that's the virtual visit, yeah. Digital visit. So somebody doesn't have to rock up in their sales rep car, their sales rep Mercedes or their BMW and come in and be all flashy with the suit and everything else. They're quite happy to have those conversations digitally like we are right now. And that's, they're very happy with that. And yeah. And they feel they can still feel a high level of personal service, but it just means that salesperson can take 10 calls a day or 15 calls a day and give very personal service versus 2 or 3 site visits per day. So we're talking all in your flip-flops if you want. Nobody will ever know that I've got flip-flops on my feet right now. And that's so good. And on my Zoom calls, nobody knows. And so I get the sense that B2B brands are still overvaluing the physical interaction of their salespeople with customers when we have such amazing digital equivalents. And where they still see that adding massive value to an account, it actually is freeing up more time for them to devote to those accounts that still demand that in-person interaction.
Yeah. One of the things that we've seen a couple of times is too that we're moving to digital solutions has forced them to rethink some of the complexities they've built in, that some of those complexities just aren't necessary as they think through them. They're like you see the spec sheets and like, are you sure you want to build that out? It seems a little complex and maybe unnecessary. But there's an aspect that is on the human side or the legacy side of things, we can make things so custom and go and just that then you try to digitize that where you have to have logic, right? There needs to be a logic that has to flow consistently. Where not everything is a one-off change variance from that system. Anyways, that's a piece that I've found sometimes too, is going digital transformation, there's a benefit to reevaluating some of those systems that you have and just making things a little bit cleaner, because that improves, what I've seen is it improves both sides of the experience, the customer buying journey. They're like, it's not confusing. They're like, it's less confusing at least. Like here, I can do this or that. It's clear what your system is and what the pricing, how it works, blah, 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 all that good stuff. but also just for the team, like that's the people who are doing the selling or the people who are fulfilling the orders in that side where it's just, there's fewer variations. So I think there's another benefit of that. I think to take advantage of that forced conversation of, is the system that we currently have worth duplicating and replicating perfectly, or should we modify it to start with some MVP or start with just simplifying it and seeing if we find that we need the complexities to add later. So that's been a fun one at times too.
I'll give you some concrete examples of exactly what you have described and the practical outcomes of a holistic review of kind of the way things are done or leveraging institutional knowledge. Because a lot of what you're referring to is institutional knowledge inside the business that sits sometimes only in the sales reps' heads, and they know exactly the print catalog that they need to go to pull out a spec in email to a customer. And so I think there's a little bit of an unfounded fear, at least on the part of sales teams, that, hey, this institutional knowledge that we've built up of years and years of being in this industry, that is our value prop as salespeople, is that we have that knowledge at our fingertips off the top of our head that we can discuss with people about. But what they don't perhaps appreciate, A, is the risk to the business if they were to get hit by a bus tomorrow, or if somebody who's a sales leader in the business was to leave the company. Where does that leave the company and its customers over the medium to long term? I think that's the first thing. And then second of all, I think those individual sales leaders, they probably overvalue some of that institutional knowledge, and what they're seeing is actually computers can, and for example, in a PIM system, a product information management system, if we can get all this data that's in our heads and institutionally within our businesses, and maybe in print catalogs or maybe in PDFs or in exploded diagrams, if we can get all that information into a structured format that then can be distributed across any channel, whether it be print, whether it be e-commerce, whether it be marketplace, doesn't really matter where we're distributing that information. It means that it's consistent across the business and it's accurate and updatable across the business. I think that's one of the things. But the other thing that I've witnessed within these businesses is that when we go in and we start doing some data rationalization, and when we start doing some data cleansing, and when we start doing some data engineering and data science across most of their data sets, we find that their data sets are usually really messy. Both product and customer data tends to be super messy because it's grown organically, quote unquote, organically over time. Sure. So they've never actually taken the opportunity to have a holistic top-down review of every single data set that they have in the business, why it's structured the way that it is. Is it consistent? Does it make sense within a digital context? And is it actually even serving our business the way that maybe it evolved to? Does it still serve a business in the way that we thought it would? And when I go into a business and I see, for example, 2,000 customer accounts within that business, 2,000 B2B customer accounts within that business, and every single one of them has a bespoke price list and catalog, I tend to think WTF. I tend to think, does that make sense? I tend to think, when you try to make business-wide pricing changes, how are we making sure that in every single instance that we're still profitable, that how can we even model out or forecast changes in our pricing models across 2,000 price lists? How is that even possible? We can't do it. We cannot do it. And so I find that when we start digging under the bonnet of this, a lot of these prices have evolved because one salesperson with one customer started to do these little tiny little tweaks, and it might be a percent here and a percent there. But when we holistically look at those 2,000 price lists, we find that, say, 92%, pulling an arbitrary number here, but 92% of those prices could be put within a series of, say, four bands, that customers could be put in within four tiers of pricing. And we may, okay, on some products, we might have to round up a little bit. On some products, we might have to round down a little bit to put them in those four pricing bands. But I find that most of these B2B brands can get all of their pricing within three, four, five pricing tiers, based on some qualifying criteria of those customers. And then it creates a massive incentive for the customer to strive to get up to that next tier of discount pricing. And so it makes it much, your pricing becomes significantly more transparent, significantly easier to manage, and significantly easier to model forecast changes to your pricing models. And I think that's just one example. And I also see restricted catalogs. I see restricted catalogs in almost every B2B business that I engage with, where they'll say, okay, not every customer can see every product. They can see a subset of our products. And maybe we bring in for those customers, there are certain SKUs that are only available to them because we brought those products specifically in to service those clients. And I don't have a problem with that. But What I do have a problem with is arbitrary rules around catalog restrictions. Because what I find is that when we ungate a catalog, the more we ungate it, the more cross-selling and upselling brands tend to do. And so if a customer just simply cannot see a product because they're restricted out of that section or that category of your catalog, they won't even know that you carry it. And unless the sales rep goes and tells them, oh, by the way, did you know we carry these other 10,000 SKUs? No, I didn't, because when I log in, I can't even see it. I can't even see those categories. All of a sudden, they oftentimes are missing out on tremendous cross-sell and upsell opportunities simply because they make their catalogs too restrictive. And this is just a common thing I see every day in the B2B world.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It just instantly makes me think of, could you imagine going to like a grocery store and you're like, you get to know who you are. You sign in with your membership card. Maybe you go to Costco and you're like, your membership card, and you're like, they funnel you this way. You can go this way. I'm like, what's over there? Don't ask. Doesn't matter. It's not your membership. Yeah,
you don't have access to that. Sorry.
Yeah. So
don't look behind the curtain.
No, but I agree. That's exactly that stuff. I'm right. And the area that I sit in is typically where sometimes they haven't fully thought through all those things, right? And so they're like, we're getting like, hey, we're digitizing. And so the core ask is a website. And that's where we come in. And so then we also have to back them up a little bit. Okay, we're building you a website. Like, we have to start with logic. What's the logic for who can see what, who can do what, your pricing, like all those things. Are all carts equal if somebody's creating a cart, or things like, just are we sharing carts across accounts and stuff so that somebody can just build it out? All that, it's all these things that we have to then introduce sometimes, these ideas. And for them, it's not a known, they don't know that these things are even possible, or that this is so it opens their eyes a bit. And it's fun, because I think the friction comes in where typically the people we're working with directly are super excited about all of it, but they're not also the ones managing the purse strings of the project. And it's helping them to explain it and get into those conversations with people who do have the control over the budgets, and having those conversations like you and I are having right now of like, hey, this is why this is beneficial to you. Here's the thing, and you should consider it for X and Y reason, and get all that so that you can start having a meaningful digital transformation so that you are unlocking for the future. I think one of the biggest joys that I have is when the horizon just seems like there's a whole new horizon. Like, when somebody's moved over, even if it's just MVP, it's like just something simple to get them started. And then all of a sudden their eyes open up of like the possibilities. Like, oh, we can do this, we can do that now. And before, they were just coming over the hilltop and they weren't even there, but now they're on the top of the mountain. They're like, I can see it all. And so it's more like reining them in. It's like, all right, hold on. Let's do a few things at a time.
Let's roadmap this. Let's not try to boil the ocean all at once.
Yeah, exactly. I honestly sometimes feel like I'm protecting clients' budget from themselves. I'm like, hey, hold on. You told me your budget is this. Let's slow down, because I want to make sure we finish things within your budget, so we're not left with, you run out of your budget and we're at 50% of 50 things. Like, that's pointless. So let's actually finish things. And I have to calm them down. But those are the moments I think why I keep doing what I'm doing in the custom website of this, is those kind of exciting moments where people feel just like the possibilities and feeling unblocked. So they're no longer just frustrated about the current systems and like just annoyed by them. And then they've got those problems solved, but now they see the possibilities, and that's just wonderful. So I think there's a lot of people experiencing that, and there's a lot of people who are hoping for that. So there's still that world where some people who have done it, they're evangelizing for it, they're advocating for it, and there's others who are just hoping, okay, I want to get there, I want to do that. And that's the world that we get to live in more, is the actual implementation of it. And it's fun to see the backside of that when they're now running, they've got sales coming in. Now their marketing team is, okay, now we can care about SEO because we've never cared about that before. And you can start entering the whole world that DTC has already been in.
And how do you, like, for me, when I go in, I feel less, most of the time, I feel less like a solution architect or a process designer or a data engineer or even an org designer. I feel less of that most of the time. And I feel more like a psychologist, a coach, maybe a counselor. I feel like oftentimes more of my job is centered around mindset, coaching, making people feel comfortable with the idea of digital, making people feel less threatened by digital technology, especially with the advent of AI, making them get comfortable with the concept of AI and how it can benefit them and their customers, helping sales teams feel like they're not going to get replaced overnight by these digital channels. I feel like there's so much groundwork that I do when I first go into the business that has absolutely nothing to do with the tech or the data, that really the conversation tends to start there. And I start to uncover when I go through discovery, and I like to think I have one of the best discovery processes in the world around this. I start to uncover, even right from the discovery phase, some of the sensitivities within the business around introducing digital channels or significantly upgrading digital capabilities in a business. And do you oftentimes run into the same scenario?
I think we're on the other side of it. So we talk to people after you, right? So if they go to somebody like you, and they, which they should, I think we typically then get where people have decided, they've got the budget, they're ready to implement something, right? And so that's where we come in. So we don't have, where we find is when the rubber's hitting the road, and then all of a sudden the reality of this thing starts to hit, add friction to conversations, right? That's the stuff we have to see and we manage through. All of a sudden, hey, the person who's our lead on this project with the client has got them set up with tax, for example, their tax systems are up. And then all of a sudden, wait a minute, you didn't have your finance person review this, like, and they're all of a sudden putting pause on things. And they're like, we got to check this. We got to make sure all these things. And part of it is just, when you do project management, then it goes, again, it goes okay. But ultimately, even with good project management, the conversations sometimes are new and unexpected because you don't know always until somebody speaks up and shares like, hey, this is a unique thing, that then those are the conversations that are the hardest ones sometimes. And we have to pause a project for a moment because we have to solve this thing that then all of a sudden there's new information that somebody didn't know about and is now presenting. And, but other than that, honestly, because we're typically at the tail end of these things, or we get to be involved in design. And so that it's, in the sense, it's classic web design stuff that we do, web design and development with custom development. But because there's so much custom integrations with B2B, there's always something. There's always some other source. And typically the types of projects we take on too, because we take on projects that really need to be custom because they don't fit on an off-the-shelf system. And those are the pieces where things have their friction or have like their moments of like, all right, we got to buckle in here and get through this and see where it goes. But no, we're at the end of it. So we don't have that. Even though I do have a degree in marriage and family therapy, I don't have to use it very often in those types of conversations, because we're the ones implementing it at that point. So the decisions have been made, the budget's already there. It's just then having the fortitude to finish it and to get through. And for us to make sure that we're providing the skills and the team to be able to have the correct implementations that they can extend from. So we're not just, I think one of the things that frustrates me sometimes in some builds is, even in first phases, there's already band-aids.
And tech debt, phase one, tech debt.
Instant. And I think for me personally, and I think the way we do work, I'm just not okay with that. And part of it is because I really want, I believe that when people are hiring us, they're really hiring us for phase one typically, and they want to be able to extend. And if you already give them something that has band-aids initially, and it's not, well, you have this dream, but you can't really get there because you're going to have to weasel your way through the code that we created because we didn't intend for you to grow or to have this mentality. And so I think that's one of the things for us that I find really important is understanding where we are in the journey. Typically when we're building new builds, we're doing new integrations, we're doing new digitalization,
I think. I don't know. I don't even know if that's a real word, but anyways, it sounds good.
Yeah, that one. So I like that one. So anyways, that's where... For us, that's the important piece for us. So we're participating in this. And we need to make sure that that's on solid foundation of when you're getting started. And it's not the shaky thing of, well, at least we got it up and live when you're running and good luck in phase two. So yeah, that's where we are.
And how often, I know that when I was working agency side and I was working as the lead solutions architect, and when I was leading discoveries with clients, somewhere between 20 and 50% of clients that came to us as an agency and we got into discovery with them, we would very soon realize you're not actually ready for discovery with an agency. You're not ready to engage with an agency yet. If 50% of the answers you give us to our questions is, we don't know, we haven't thought about that, aren't you supposed to be the experts? Aren't you supposed to be telling us what we want? That is a red flag for me when I was working agency side. And that usually signified that the client was not in a position to be able to define their requirements or even identify their requirements, let alone document or articulate them to me as an agency so that we could build something that was appropriate for their needs. And that's where we would usually kick them back out again. And we would kick them back to a consultancy usually, because most agencies are not wired to be consultancy heavy. They're not designed to have 3 or 4 months of consultancy with a client before they get a complete scope or even a BRD. They're just not wired that way. And in fact, they don't have the number of heavy hitting resources they would need to be able to offer those services to every client that walks through the door. Where they're usually heavy from a resource perspective is on the dev front. So they might have 20, 30, 40 devs, but they might have one solution architect, one strategist, one or two PMs, one or two AMs, and maybe one or two designers. And that might be it. But where they can scale is in their actual delivery capability. So if they get bogged down with a whole bunch of clients that are not even ready, they have no idea how to identify their own requirements internally, that's where it can become a really hard slog for agencies.
Yeah, it becomes really difficult. The ones that excite me are when they come and they have this full spec sheet of things. I'm like, this is beautiful. You've been here before. So that's the stuff I love. I think for us at Foster Commerce and where we're positioned is we are better positioned for companies that have been around. So companies who know what they're doing, been around. Even if it's we've not done digital before, they still have rules. They still have something. They still have these things they've been selling for years. And so they have all that figured out. They just need help going digital with it. And that's perfect for us because in that sense, because then we're good at parsing out like what the rules they currently have and like the things and then getting them signed up for if they need new services, upgrade their PayPal if they're using PayPal from the old legacy PayPal stuff that people still use or whatever it is. Yeah, in our world then, they're typically mature businesses, been around for a while. And if they're still figuring those pieces out, and maybe your experience is a little bit different because I've not seen, at least for us, like there have been sub businesses, but they fit better on off the shelf because we get B2C stuff too. We get B2B stuff. The B2B stuff, honestly, by the time they get to us, they've mostly had their stuff figured out enough. And so that's good. The B2C stuff is the one where oftentimes we'll kick them back out to an off the shelf system saying like, you're early enough. Like adjust your business to the platform.
As opposed to the other way around.
Yeah. 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 Because they're early enough. Get some more revenue, get some stuff. But like B2B, I think the thing that we see is it's harder to go off the shelf because of all those things you talked about, right? Even if you try to convince them to narrow down and to streamline and to have a single logic flow. Even at that point, the off the shelf, like SaaS systems, they're still made for the masses, right? In B2B, there's so much customization in each business. And I think that's why we do what we do, because we just fit the niche of people who just don't fit on off the shelf platforms. Even if it's just because that one integration, but it's so integral to everything they do that they have to have it and it doesn't fit on the off-the-shelf systems. And so that's where we come in with the custom builds. And so that's the world we get to live in, where a lot of times then they still have that stuff solved, other things. And it's just more about, okay, we've got to do this custom. And the benefit for us, I think, to pitch myself here a little bit, is we come with a pre-built kind of mentality. Like we use a specific platform called Craft CMS and it's commerce solution. And on top of that, we have our own layer that is this pre-built headless thing that's we call Commerce Foundations that essentially is this accelerator that gets people going. And so we don't have to have all those things, because typically when you go custom, what you lose is the stuff that is repeated in every build, right? There's a cart in every build.
The home, the category, the product page, the cart, and the checkout. You lose all those. And it's like, why do we build those from scratch every time?
Exactly. So that's what we have. You just don't have to build all that stuff from scratch. Like you have your core things, but then it's a platform that has no rules in the sense like you can extend as far as you need to, and it's the benefit of custom. So it's like this pre-started custom solution that kind of goes from there. And so that's the world I love, because I think for me, just in my interest and the things that excite me, is I'm also the one who, I don't like black boxes of stuff. Like I don't like working in code and things that I can't see, I can't open it up. And so when things are off limits, I'm like, I want to work on the stuff I can touch and manipulate and get in and make sure it's clean and good stuff. I hate being held captive to that vendor doesn't think it's a priority, so they're not going to update it. That's the world that we typically find ourselves in, is there these B2B companies who don't fit the off the shelf, already have some of their answers on that stuff, and they just have to go custom because of the way that they think of things. So honestly, the bigger question that we face and are typically are trying to solve for people when they're consulting at our level is essentially, is custom the right way, right? The phrasing is build or buy, right? So we're going to build it, custom, own it, have our thing, or we're going to buy it. And to me, it's actually, it's rent or own kind of a mentality. So you're going to rent your store, your e-store on a SaaS platform, or are you going to own it? And so we're on the build and the own side. There's plenty of reasons why people go to the rent side, but that's the conversations. Are you sure you need to be owning? Are you sure you need to be building? Because I don't want to lead people down that path if renting is just fine.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. And for those that maybe haven't heard of Craft before, I have obviously because I'm in the space, but for those that haven't heard of Craft, maybe they've heard of something like Expression Engine, or maybe they've heard of something like WordPress. You can think of Craft almost like a CMS on steroids that has some commerce functionality, but it's interesting that you've chosen to standardize on Craft because it's not typically known as a commerce engine. It's known more for its CMS capabilities than it is for its commerce capabilities. So it's interesting that you've decided to standardize on Craft. What precipitated that decision in the business?
It's just good. It's a hidden gem.
I love the honesty. It's just good.
It's hard. So I'll tell you, here's the pain point for me. And then I'll answer your question. Craft is a bootstrap company. Like, they don't have a marketing team. They don't have funding. They don't have any of that stuff. So they don't have a marketing team to help get the word out and that stuff. So in a lot of ways, we try to become the marketing team for Craft Commerce, because the more we can share about how good this platform is, we get some of that. But it's also what's exciting to me. But yeah, they don't put a lot of money into marketing. Like, they just worked with devs, and as devs like love their platform, they grow, and it's been just this organic thing. I think what out of 2023, Cloudflare did this thing of all their top 5,000 websites, number of Craft websites, and these aren't commerce ones always, but the number of Craft websites was similar share to Squarespace. Imagine the marketing budgets between those.
It's insane, right?
But the commerce team at Craft, everything is built on Craft itself, right? So it starts with a core platform, and the core platform of Craft itself is just, to me, is just phenomenal. It allows you to build what you need to build without all the extra bloat, right? You can go headless, you can be headed and use on Twig stuff, right? So you have all that stuff. You can build it the way you need to. And the commerce side just builds on top of that. Of the key pieces is it tries to be as opinionless as possible, so that you can do what you need to do. And that's where we get to come in and bring our expertise of then, okay, if you work with us, we have an opinion on top of that. And Craft allows us to get there and do our opinion layer on top of it. And what that means is that none of it is like finagling code or working around. It's not gerrymandering like how the system works. And so it's just clean. And I think that's why we like it. It's open source, so we get to see the code. Like, we're working in it. We can do all that stuff. And they just have come out with Commerce 5, speaking of B2B. And this is, I known has been coming, because like we talked to them, we know the team, and we've been waiting for this moment. You could have done B2B stuff in Craft itself, because you can extend anything you want. But they've made first party more B2B centric abilities, which to me is just phenomenal. So like Priceless Things is now just first party, as opposed to having to just make it your own. They have multi-store, multi-currency, which you can just do in your own, multi-warehouse kind of stuff. All of these kind of things.
What we call primitives, right? They have all the data primitives that you would need to not have to, for example, instead of creating product attributes that are the customer prices, for example, which is how you can do it, or instead of putting an attribute for the inventory values for a specific warehouse as a custom attribute of the product, now those data primitives are out of the box. So you don't have to build from scratch effectively to achieve all those things.
Yep. And we know some people who have, in previous versions of Craft, have just had to build their own, add their own unique fields for the meaning of what that is. But yeah, now it's going to be in their first party, which then just opens it. When Craft adds it first party, it just makes it easier for everyone, because now we're talking the same language and builds start to have some commonalities, as opposed to every build being so different that you can't. And that's the drawback of going custom a little bit sometimes. Like, for everybody who's on similar systems, they can start to have a community of, hey, I'm on this platform. How do I do it this way? And so that's honestly where we're trying to come in as well, is bring some commonality on the our layer of craft and stuff. But yeah, it's a beautiful system. We talk to people on our podcast about like why they've chosen Craft Commerce. We just had a wonderful conversation with somebody else too, that they're building like 10 different sites, and they have a bunch of B2B things, their aftermarket automotive stuff, and they're all 100% in craft and craft commerce. And they're very excited for the B2B solutions as well, what it's going to open for them. So I think it's a whole different world. I think what we struggle is this little hidden gem. There's this little hidden gem of a world of this craft solutions, because there's no marketing budget behind it compared to the Goliath of this industry. And so we're just going to sit in our little corner and serve everyone we can as best as we can and give them these phenomenal solutions, I think at a cheaper level than typically you find in the other solutions. I talk to people who are building and I'm like, how much would it cost you for this? And they tell me the numbers. I'm like, I should start charging more. It's just, it's attainable at a lower level, even ongoing costs. And why pay that SaaS fee if you don't have to?
Definitely. And I'm very good friends with Oliver Rhodes of Nolo Apps in the UK. You may or may not know him from LinkedIn, but there he's building apps on Airtable and he's building the middleware apps. So the PIM systems, the PLM systems, a lot of those other systems that you'd have to buy, very expensive, very enterprise class systems in the SaaS, or even for that matter, in the on-prem world, he's building very lightweight versions of those apps that are very tailorable to specific use cases within brands, where they spend a fixed amount of money up front, and then they've really only just got their Airtable hosting fees. They've really just got their Airtable hosting fees on an ongoing basis, which is extremely accessible to most brands. They're a mid-market brand or larger. Okay, maybe not at the smallest end of town, but if you're doing, say, 2 million or more in revs every year, you could probably afford an Airtable app, and you could probably afford the monthly fee for Airtable. And so I feel like there is this pushback against some of the monoliths in the space, not to say that they don't have their place too, because I'm a massive fan of SaaS. I'm a massive advocate of SaaS. Most of my consulting is on SaaS platforms because I've seen the transformational power of SaaS, especially once you get to 20 million plus a year, which is primarily where I consult, not exclusively. Most of the brands I work with are doing $20 million or more a year in GMV, and they're ready to scale. And maybe they only have an ERP at this stage, and they know the value of a PIM, but they don't know how to scope it. They don't know how to do search and select. They don't know how to do the data architecture for a PIM. They don't know any of those things. Or maybe they don't. Maybe they need a PLM system, and they don't even know where to start to look for a PLM system or something like that. And so how often do you get into an engagement with a client and you realize, geez, okay, they've got an ERP, maybe they got NetSuite or D365 or Epicor, whatever it is they might have, and they're semi-using it as a PIM. So they've got maybe more attributes in their ERP than what you would traditionally want to see in an ERP, because I normally like to see just the base data. I like to see maybe a name, a SKU, maybe a short description, a price, and inventory. And that's where most ERPs should begin and end from a product data perspective. Yeah, you can shoehorn a bunch of other product attributes in there, but that's where a PIM starts to make a heck of a lot of sense.
Reviews in there? Are you sure?
Yeah, for some reason, call me crazy. I don't want customer reviews in my ERP. Yeah. Right. But I get the sense that, at least in my case, a lot of the clients that I go to consult with, because they are a little bit more old school, generally speaking, they don't even know what's possible. Similar to how you described, our clients don't even necessarily know what's possible. And until we show them what's possible, then the light bulbs go on and then they get super excited and then they want to do everything. And okay, yes, you could do everything, but let's draw this back and let's build out an MVP that we can get you live in 6 to 9 months. And it's not going to take 2 years to get you live and start getting ROI on this, or your clients to get starting to get ROI on this. How often do you go in and they're just not ready because maybe they've only gotten ERP and that's it? And they need a couple of other things. They need a couple of other components in the stack to get them where they need to be, because an e-commerce platform on their own is just not, it's just not going to get them there.
So we've had situations where, because they're not ready for integration X in that way from the ERP or whatever, then we've decided what we typically do is just then say, or try to have the conversation around, okay, what's scope for our current work? What is the MVP then? It sounds like we're reducing the MVP. And so let's figure out what that is so that we don't have to have the stress of that thing. Can we still go forward? How essential is that thing? If it's not essential, you can still do some movement forward without it. I think so. Yeah, we've had times where we expected to integrate an ERP and it didn't happen because they realize as they dive into it, they're not ready. Like, they have many things happening. And it happens. It definitely happens. I think what's nice though is there's always something, right? There's always something valuable that you can begin with. And so then it's just figure that out, right? And get it to where you're going. And then they can decide internally, okay, like, where's the pressure now? Is our pressure to clean up that system so that we can get it integrated? Or is our pressure somewhere else? Let's just try to sell the ones that we already have and the things that we can do currently. It changes their, what it changes the reality of where they are. They need to take stock of where that is and then make their decision. So yeah, there's moments where they're not fully ready for like as much as they originally wanted. They might have to make some other investments in other systems. Goodness, we've been waiting some system. I stopped bringing it up, but like in our weekly or monthly calls, I'm like, so how's this one going? I'm stop asking. It's not, we're not going to finish that because we don't want to sometimes pay for the service to make this system better. We have to have this other one, but they don't want to invest in another one, which is fine. It's their businesses. And so it's our job to make do with what we can to make it valuable for them. And I think that's where we come in of being, helping them to be as lean as possible to just have something up and running that's working, that allows them to then see the value of it and keep investing in it. Cause that's where we want to be. I don't want to build stuff that like is not going to bring value to a company. That would be miserable. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's my thought is around that. It's
like we fixed. No, I think you answered it perfectly. And I wonder if you also bump into some areas like I have where, for example, maybe 20% of their catalog would require a full-blown CPQ because it's just so complex.
Yeah.
But maybe 80% of their catalog is fixed SKU, fixed price, no variance. It's just, here's the product. We can sell this product all day long, every day. And so you have to have a very rational conversation with them and say, look, maybe we can't do this 20 or 30% of the catalog because of the complexity of getting those products online in a meaningful way to where they could be configured and selected properly by the customer in a workflow-based process. And maybe that would double the scope of the project, just that 20% of the catalog. But why don't we get you live with the 80% of the SKUs that you can sell tomorrow in a very simple, streamlined way? You've got prices for every customer. You've got MOQs. You've got buying increments. All the information you need to have to be able to actually sell this product.
Yeah.
So let's get you online with a subset of your catalog, and or maybe even let's look at the top 20% of your catalog that gets sold. Look at the top 20% of SKUs that are sold day in, day out, that make up 80% of your revenue, and let's get those products live. Let's focus on those. Let's really drill down on those and make sure that is an amazing buying experience for that 20% of the catalog that drives the bulk of your revenue. And then let's land and expand from there, and let's get into the more complex stuff as a roadmap of work over time, as opposed to, I liken it to eating the elephant one bite at a time, and that's how I describe it.
Yeah, I think it's exactly it. Yeah, exactly. Honestly. So I think the benefit of the solutions that we build, right, in Craft Commerce, going custom is what you're talking about of like those unique workflows that need to happen or those. That's why I like building in the tooling that we do, because you can just do that, right? There's nothing that's blocking you. So I think in our mentality, and I think the situations that we've seen, I'm thinking through a few sites that have those kind of moments where like most of the stuff is straightforward, single SKU kind of products. Other ones are like, come in and it's a configurator. These are going to be complex. And it's not too, maybe I haven't seen it at all, but it's not too different than just a product that has a lot of variants. Lot of different
options. And you have three different stages of dropdowns, for example, and maybe there's 20 options within each dropdown. Yeah. Okay, cool. That's understandable.
It's variant management. It's like, all right, so you're figuring out, it's more about then, it's the variant management aspect of it. It's like, where do you get all this information? How is it being imported? Is it API? Is it CSV? Is it manual? What are we doing? Either way, but the front end buying experience is then, it's more about permission. So as we've talked about before, does the person have permission to access this one? But hopefully the UI is not the problem. The UI should be, there's solutions. It's all been figured out at some level, all the complex UIs. But honestly, I think the thing that we face is sometimes companies going international. Well, somebody who's starting in the US or they've been in the US, and part of them going digital or improving their digital is now we're going international. And for them, that might mean Canada, Mexico originally, or it might mean Europe, which then those are the fun conversations we get to have of, have you sold in Europe yet? And they're like, no, we're not selling in Europe yet. So now we're at the very beginning of that consulting aspect of, okay, this is brand new for you. here's what it means, at least from a digital side, to sell to Europe. Like, you're going to need receipts in the certain levels. You're going to have, you might know our
currencies, taxes, logistics. Yep. Have you thought about any of those things?
Yeah. LTL stuff. Like, how are you promising delivery times? Are you having warehouses over there? What are we doing? And so those are the conversations that then, what you're saying, where it might become an agency. Maybe you should go back out to a consultant at this point. Come back to us once you have your specs. So that happens. It's what I like, no matter what, is that we're part of companies that then, like, they're growing now. They're like, all right, we got to think about warehousing in Europe, or we're in, you know, somewhere else. We got to think about warehousing in the US. We're going to start selling in the US. And anyways, those pieces is fun. And that's what's cool about when you pitch going custom here. When you go custom, you can go any of that. You can just do it. It's your code. You can do whatever you want, as long as you have a smart team.
The double-edged sword side of that is, you can do whatever you want. So there's arguments to be made both directions.
Let's not talk about that one.
Absolutely. Love it. And how do you think about, like, when you think about integrations, and I've seen this pretty routinely, and I'd love to know whether you've seen this as well, that oftentimes the integration part of the project can be the most complex and the most costly part. Oh, yeah. Of the actual build, is that sometimes a build might be, I don't know, it could be $100,000, but then you have a $200,000 integration because they're integrating to maybe two ERPs, they're integrating to 3PLs, owned warehouses, they're integrating to a PIM system, they're integrating to a real-time fitment system on the front end through the storefront, automatic filtration for fitment, especially for vehicle parts, etc. I have seen integrations get insanely complex, particularly where there needs to be data transformation and, say, a staging table in middleware, where we need to do some wacky, crazy data transformation in middleware before it ends up in its destination or when it's picked up from a source. It needs to be transformed, or it needs to be combined, or whatever it needs to be done. Yeah. And I've seen this in the telecoms industry. I've seen certain verticals are so integration heavy that this can be the most complex part of the build. The front end is maybe pretty straightforward, but the integration is insane.
No, it's exactly right. The integrations are definitely a thing. We don't often have to work in middleware because in Craft, like, we can transform data on the way in or on the way out. So we can create those APIs exactly as we need, either on the receiving side or the sending sides. That's just par for the course for us. As, okay, how does this data need to be received? Let's create the API that way. And it's all against the headless mantra, against the mock mantra. It's all monolith at that point, right? But it works. You don't have to have all these different logins. But the integrations, yes, 100%. Integrations are where, especially if it's not one that's been set up before, if it's unique to you, or then you've customized that that integration in your warehouses in a certain way, then you're working with the abilities of that integration system. We've seen some that have horrible documentation, so we're just figuring out documentation as we hit the endpoints. We're like, okay, what is this endpoint giving back? And you're just discovering as you're writing. I mean, it's just,
when I use Postman and I send a call, what is the response I bloody well get? Let's document that.
There you go. Yep. So sometimes we don't know what we're walking into. It's, here's a flashlight and a pickaxe and figure out what you find. So the integrations are definitely time consuming. And I think it doesn't even matter, because, like, you can have pre-built solutions. I think that's the thing that we're trying to do. I think a lot of companies are trying to do is to try to think about those things and have pre-built solutions so that things can or get to market faster. You have fewer of those moments. So it's going to take years before all these companies that finally digitize, where then maybe we're going to have more and more that the integrations are a little bit more caught up and seamless. But I think, even honestly, sometimes just the shipment, the carrier just attaching to the carriers, and a lot of them have good APIs and it's okay. But then the rules that you have to have, we're not sending to that carrier unless the order looks like this, right? Mm-hmm. So it's integrations and it's custom logic to make sure you only hit an integration at a certain point. That's the world we live in. And it's all logic. It's setting up rules. Code is linear in that sense. So it's figuring out what is that linear path for if this, then that. All day long.
And there are even in a custom build environment, there are some off-the-shelf tools to where you don't necessarily have to build every single component from scratch. Correct. In the Craft Logic, for example, there's Shipper HQ, there's Avalara for tax. There's certain plug-in type systems that, yes, you have to integrate it into the front end. And yes, you maybe have to integrate it into admin. Yes, there's certain rules that you have to set up in those systems to make sure that the rule sets are followed. And there's carrier aggregators that already integrate with, say, the 50 top carriers, to where basically you load your matrix rates into that platform and then boom, then they'll surface the right, if for the right cart configuration. They'll surface the right carriers based on price, based on performance or service level. So there are technologies out there that I think, you know, what I want to convey mainly to the audience is just because you might be going with more of a almost like a mock type approach or more headless type of approach, even you're not building, for example, you're not building the entire front end out in React. You're building it out in the Craft platform. So you're still using a platform to do the build, but it just gives you a certain amount of flexibility that maybe you wouldn't get with other alternative systems. But more than anything else, what I'm trying to convey is that you can mix and match in that custom build environment. It doesn't mean, okay, I'm going to go build out my entire shipping rules engine from scratch.
No.
If I don't need to, there is certain technology out there that can do the heavy lifting of that part. And then all that needs to happen is that tool then needs to be integrated in with your e-commerce platform. And so I don't want to, I guess I want to make sure that we're describing things accurately, which is to say freedom and flexibility are amazing, but it doesn't always make sense to build out a component custom if there's something off the shelf that does it better, faster, cheaper, and more cost effectively.
Yeah, typically tell clients that like, hey, we have this shipping service, but we're not tied to it. And I'll say, okay, great, because we recommend this one because it's already built. Is that a move you can make? Let's just go to that. Like, we don't need to spend time building out. Like, why? So on that piece, but what's true is in the SaaS world, there's customization that still happens. That happens at the there are expensive builds either way, no matter like.
Correct.
And either way, there's things that you can pre-use and there's things you're going to go custom with. So no matter what platform you're going with. And I think the thing for us, we like a platform that still then when you get to those moments of going custom, then you can do whatever you just need in an efficient way. Without waiting for a vendor to do something to make it possible. So it's those moments of my job is to unblock companies and I don't want to be blocked by the tech. All right. So that's why we choose the tech we do so that we can just have our mission of unblocking companies to do more. And so I think it's a spot on kind of point of like how that goes. But yeah, use the things that already exist. Right.
Wherever you can and wherever it makes sense commercially to do. Steven, this has been an hour has absolutely ripped by. I can't believe it's been an hour. I super appreciate your time. This conversation about the B2B world, I'm trying to stimulate as many and be the vector for as many of these B2B conversations as I possibly can, because I think that it has been underserved in the market for so long and it's been under the radar of many commerce companies, many agencies, many tech vendors. It's been under the radar for so many years, but when we look out across the CAGR forecast by many sources of growth in the B2B e-commerce sector up until 2030, it's anywhere from 15 to 20% forecast growth, CAGR, compound annual growth rate. So the time has come. We can't ignore B2B e-commerce anymore. And I don't think brands can ignore B2B e-commerce anymore. And so I'm trying to just really get the word out and I guess be an evangelist for B2B e-commerce, because I think it's so transformative, especially for legacy businesses. It is so transformative for their business in a good way that it just can't be ignored anymore. And I still see a lot of B2B brands, legacy brands, burying their head in the sand. And I'm trying to get the word out that A, that's not a viable business model. Hope is not a strategy. First of all. Second of all, you got clients and an increasing cohort of clients that want to buy from you online. Maybe not everything from you online. And maybe they still have a relationship with you for certain products and certain experiences and certain scenarios. Maybe they've got it. But for replenishment ordering, the vast majority of your customers want to buy online from you. It's that simple. The buying generation, the B2B buying generation is younger than ever now. And they're being the old legacy B2B buyers are being replaced by a new generation of buyers that expect digital capabilities from their suppliers. And the search for suppliers is oftentimes now starting digitally. In the same way that they would Google a new dress, they're going to Google a supplier of a brake pad or a pump or whatever it might be. And so their search is starting digitally. And if your catalog is hidden behind a login and it can't even be indexed by Google, then you're not going to be inside the consideration set of digital first buyers. It is that simple. And so I'm just trying to help these conversations happen at scale, at minimum of once a week, to where we can get the word out that it is now more cost effective. It is now more possible than ever before to implement a really well thought out, crafted B2B e-commerce experience without absolutely destroying your business or breaking the bank in the process. And so I super appreciate you coming along and helping to contribute to that discussion and that advocacy.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great conversation. I appreciate you having on, and I appreciate the voice that you have in this community.
Love it. And now we're at the time where I get to flip the script. And I know you already asked me a couple of questions at the beginning, but now I love the part of the podcast where I get to hand the microphone over to my guests, let them ask me one question, any question they like. So Stephen Callender from Foster Commerce, what is your question for me today?
Oh man, I got a lot of questions. Let me narrow this down. So I won't ask you a trivia question about Mexico because I've already done that.
Thank God, because I'll probably get it wrong. And I'll be embarrassed. So let's not do that.
I'd say, so like when you're talking to these companies, these people who are looking to come on to more digital mature platforms, I guess the main thing that you're seeing is if they were going to do MVP, and I know we've said B2B is like so specific and custom and each thing has their own thing, but right, generalize as much as possible. Live in my little world real quick. Generalize the B2B and you're saying the MVP, like, for B2B getting digital transformation, like for you, what are you telling people or what would you tell people are like, I'm not going to limit you to five things. What are the just absolute essentials for being successful for a B2B company to when they're going digital?
Yeah, the first two problems I encounter in probably 95% of situations is a massive challenge with data. It's product data and it's customer data. I usually go in and one of the first questions I ask, can you give me a sample of 10 products that are representative of maybe one product per category of all the categories of products you sell? Give me one product data set from wherever you hold your data. And it might be in three different systems, but give me as complete of a product data set as you can so that I can look at this across 10 different products. And then can you give me 10 customer accounts worth of data so that I can look at it and I can see how you structure them, how you can structure their locations, how you structure their buying tiers, how you structure their pricing, how you structure their authorization and permission structures, how they're assigned to salespeople, and are they in tiers and all that sort of stuff. So show me along with that sample of price lists, et cetera. Because in the B2B world, price is an attribute of the customer, not an attribute of the product. And that's also a very different thing versus the B2C world, where price is an attribute of the product, not an attribute of the customer. And so I say, give me samples. And that is where we usually start. Even before we get into full-blown discovery, as part of discovery, I will ask them to provide me samples of data. And I can usually, right from that initial review, and it takes me an hour, I usually from there can tell them where all their pain points either are that they recognize or pain points will be that they don't yet recognize. And usually it's a process of getting their data ready for digital channels first. That's the first hurdle. And so assuming that's right, and we know where the data is coming from, we know what structure it needs to be in, it's consistent, it's relatively complete, it's got maybe an image or two against it to where we can actually present this in a digital way that's merchandised properly, and that we've got the attributes in the right places so that we can have the right filters, because in a category of products in B2B, they could have 10,000 products in a category, and with no structured data, we can't filter those products. And we don't want to present customers with 10,000 products in a product category. So how can we meaningfully add attributes that allow customers to filter down to a subset of five products very quickly and easily? Or how can we put in an enterprise search platform that can allow them to do that across unstructured data, et cetera? So it all starts with a data conversation. And then from there, then we work backwards from the technology that they already have that absolutely must stay in place. Okay, you're not touching my ERP is usually the response. You are not touching my ERP. We've spent $500,000 on our ERP. You are not touching that thing. So it is the single source of truth for these 10 data sets, and you're not moving them. So whatever you do has got to be separate to that. And then we work backwards from there. And we really primarily work from what is the front end experience you want your customers to have. Let's not think about the tech yet. We don't need to. Let's work backwards. Let's work backwards from the experience you want to create and what efficiencies you want to bring to the back end of your business at the same time. Then we can work from there to the tech and the architecture and the data flows and integration and everything else. So those are the biggest stumbling blocks because usually when I get to a client similar to you, they already know they need to do something. So they're already bought in that we need to make a change. We know we need to make a change. But they don't know how to identify the requirements. They don't know how to define them, document them, communicate them. They don't know how to put it in terminology that agencies can understand so that the agency can put a fair and reasonable proposal against that set of requirements. And that's where I really come in. And I'll do the high-level solution architecture and data flows and all that sort of stuff for them. And so these are the challenges. And again, I would say in greater than 90% of situations, data is the blocker to adopting digital channels. And until we get that right, and the second one would be, and I ran into this just recently, the second one is unrepeatable processes. So if every single way and time that you engage with a client is 100% bespoke, I was consulting to a packaging manufacturer, and their packaging is one, they are an elite, they're in a very niche group of manufacturers globally that can make custom transport packaging for things like mirrors in satellites. So very fragile goods, very uniquely shaped goods where they will blow mold the interior packaging. They will custom make the exterior wooden crate, and it has to comply with international shipping standards and all these things. And unfortunately, that like they wanted to try to move more towards a B2B e-commerce experience for their packaging solutions. But every single engagement is 100% bespoke. They don't even have a standard discovery process that they go through with the client. It usually starts with an email from the client. And then the client talks directly with an engineer, a design engineer. And then they end up with usually a CAD drawing that the client signs off on, and maybe a prototype. And so I was just like, until you can bring some form of standardization to your engagement process with your customers and something that ultimately results in a quote, You won't be able to do B2B e-commerce, because I can't translate a bespoke system into a digital equivalent. Yeah, and that's the challenge.
That's like a service agency almost. Like it's a service business that has custom solutions. Yeah, that's a good point.
Listen, Steven, this has been fantastic. I'm going to put your LinkedIn link in the show notes. I will also put your website in the show notes. Other than those two ways, how do you like people to get a hold of you and have a conversation about B2B e-commerce?
Yeah, absolutely. The LinkedIn website, that's it. I'd love for you to use the contact page. That would be phenomenal.
Fantastic. I absolutely love it. Steven, this has been a fabulous chat. I've super enjoyed it. It was super enjoyable to be on your podcast. And I love it that you are out there evangelizing B2B e-commerce. We need more of you out there. And I can't wait to speak to you again soon, my friend.
Sounds good. Appreciate it.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.